Hi, my name's Mike Nagrant, and you're listening to Hungry Magazine from Chicago, Illinois.
Four, three, two.
One more time.
Hey there, everyone. How's it going? You know, I'm really excited. In a few hours, I'm leaving for a big food trip to Montreal, Quebec City, and Maine. And looking forward to some Montreal eats like poutine, which is basically French fries with cheese curds and gravy. Some sugar pie, some smoked meat, which is like brisket, which is available at a lot of the delis in Quebec. You know, I'm looking forward to eating at Au Pied de Cochon, which is Martin Picard's restaurant. It's a restaurant that's kind of like a foie gras mecca. They also have a lot of other really good fish dishes, I understand, in the summertime. You know, I'm looking forward to hitting some of the big markets up in Montreal, like Jean Talon and Atwater. And, you know, I hope to bring you some sound tours, and I hope to bring you some information in a few weeks, so stay tuned for that. You know, as I mentioned a few weeks ago, Julius Meinl Coffee House here in Chicago was kind enough to donate coffee and tea to our listeners, and I wanted to announce the winners of that giveaway, so without further ado, there's Cheryl O'Reilly and Andy Chance. Hey, congratulations, guys. You know, I'll drop you an email to settle the details, and for the rest of you, thanks for signing up for the email list. I expect there'll be a lot more giveaways in the near future, so please stay tuned. My interview guest this week is Alpana Singh, the Director of Wine and Spirits for Let Us Entertain You Enterprises. Let Us Entertain You is a big restaurant innovations company here in Chicago. Alpana is also a master sommelier, and she was the youngest to pass the exam at age 26. You know, there's only 120 master sommeliers worldwide, and in North America, only 13 are women. The blind tasting portion of the exam is really difficult. Basically, you get six wines, it's a blind tasting, and the sommelier has to identify the varietal, the country of origin, the district of origin, and the vintage of those wines. As you can imagine, there's thousands of wines that they could choose from, and it's pretty difficult to figure out just six. Some might also recognize her as the host of Chicago's Check Please here on PBS. For those of you who've never seen the show, you basically have three average Joe folks from Chicago, you know, people basically off the street, not necessarily food experts, although some people have greater food knowledge. And what they do is they pick their favorite restaurant, and all three of the people eat at those restaurants, and they come back and discuss the restaurants. And, you know, sometimes it can get pretty contentious, and sometimes, you know, people just get along. But it's just fun to see people from different walks of life talking about restaurants, and not necessarily food experts, more about the joy of food.
You do a lot of baking?
I do a lot of cooking, actually. You know, being in the restaurant business, you know, you realize that restaurants are great places to eat, but not exactly the most healthy option.
Sure.
You know, there's always ways to sneak in butter and, you know, yeah. You know, some sort of, you know, ingredient that you probably didn't want. So we try to, like, balance our eating life with our healthy life. And so I like to see what goes into it, and I like to get creative. It's amazing what you can do with tofu. I mean, it's really fascinating. So, and I enjoy the process. I think you learn a lot about cooking. You see it in the restaurants or, you know, whatever, brown food all the time, and then just actually stew it yourself. It's actually very therapeutic and relaxing. So, unfortunately, I'm not one of those cooks that I can just reheat something. Like, even reheating ends up being like a complete change from what it used to be. So it's like, you know, try to make like pasta, and then it'll end up being like this big timbal extravaganza.
Yeah, so. my in-laws are in town this weekend, and so it's like whenever people are over, I love to cook as well.
Oh, it's great. It's very therapeutic.
Yeah, and it's like, but it's like I always go overboard, you know? It's like I have to do like five courses, and you're like, you know, they don't care.
No, it's true. It's so true. I was actually, Charles's friend is an editor for French Magazine, and he just broke up with his girlfriend, and he was telling us about his other girlfriend that he had, and he said she used to cook, and then would either stop halfway, like give up on the project, like I don't want to do this anymore after like some elaborate process, or she wouldn't clean up. I said, well, if you think about it, cleaning up is better because at least you ate. I mean,
true.
Stopping halfway, I mean, not only do you have to clean up the mess, but you didn't eat anything.
There's
at all.
Fruits of your labor.
Yeah, I'm just like, that's really funny. Like, I can't imagine like starting like a lasagna or something. Like, you know, I'm not into it anymore. And just, like, and then you just go sit down or like, well, what about the lasagna? Like,
I guess it's good you know your limits, though. I know, like, so many people think they like to cook, but they get so stressed out in the kitchen, and it's like, if it's stressful, you don't like to cook.
Well, the dirty secret about the food business is that some of these recipes in these beautiful cookbooks just don't work.
Sure.
And I think it's awful, because not only do you have to go to the expense of, like, buying you know, the ingredients, and then you try to cook it, and you spend time, and then you feel like, well, it's not Jean-Georges, it's me. Yeah. You know, and actually, I had a cookbook from him, and I looked at him like, this isn't possible. Like, this is not, I know enough about cooking to know that this recipe is not going to work out.
Yeah.
You know, sure, it's a beautiful cookbook, and it looks great and everything, and, you know, yes, I want to cook like that, but, you know, I just think it's unfortunate sometimes when people, like, take the, you know, they go get the caviar and, you know, the creme fraiche and everything, and they try to make pasta out of it, and it looks like a gloopy, grainy mess.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's funny, because I was talking with Michael Ruhlman, who wrote, he co-wrote the French Laundry Cookbook, and he was telling me about how, you know, they're just, you know, with Thomas Keller, they're very rigorous about, you know, they have, like, recipe testing upon recipe testing. He's like, it's this great endeavor. You start out like a kid in a candy store when you're writing a cookbook, and by the end you hate it because it's not, you know, this love, it's this endeavor of love. It's this endeavor of repetition.
No, it's true. You know, as good as the Barefoot Contessa, her cookbooks are awesome. Everything works out. It's a dream. You feel powerful. You feel successful. But, you know, I like Epicurious.com, and it's so funny because I log on, like, 6 times a day, because I'm like, okay, 3 o'clock rolls around, you're like, what am I going to cook tonight? Mm-hmm. So you log on, and then if it gets like 2 forks, I'm like, ah, it's like, you know, it's cursed.
Yeah. I mean, I started out, well, it's good that they have that rating system, because that at least gives the sense.
If you
like,
read it, it's really funny, though, because you just, people, like, it's a yuck, or no, or I changed this, or changed that, and it didn't work out, I don't know what went wrong, I'm like, well, you changed it. Or you just see how much license people take with recipes, and, you know, it's really, I mean, I enjoy reading the reviews more than actually the recipes, because, you know, again, it comes down to, do these recipes work or not? And here you have a forum where they're trying to figure out, I tried it, it didn't work for me, but this is what I did, you know, this is how it came out.
Well, it's interesting how much variation there is, too. I mean, people will be like, oh, this was great, and then the next one will be like, this is the worst recipe I ever made.
Yeah.
Like, it's kind of like Amazon reviews or...
Oh, God.
Or even Metro Mix or, like, you know, people... There's just so much variation.
The Metro Mix thing cracks me up. It really does. I worked at Everest, and so, you know, we get reviews, and sometimes they're not so flattering. And one of the major reasons why people wrote bad reviews is because they didn't get a window table. And so there were four window tables, and sometimes we could trace back to them, you know, where that exactly happened, or any of these, like, reviews, like, on, like, City Search or on AOL or whatever. And so you go on there, like, hey, I remember that person. That's not what happened. You know, but as a business, you can't really do anything about it. And I'm not saying that, you know, sometimes they're not warranted or whatever. I'm not saying that. But sometimes people get really personal because they did not get the right table or whatever. And that actually happens on Check Please a lot, where being in this side of the business, you understand that there's always two sides of the story. And so when somebody doesn't like a restaurant, you know, really have to take the effort to find out, well, what happened? You know, did something go wrong? Did you fight with your boyfriend? Did you fight with your wife? Did you not find the, you know, the building? Like, what happened that you didn't like your experience? And then, oh, the food was fine, but, you know, I didn't like my table. It's like, well, some people don't care about where they sit. You know, I actually had a guy one night at Everest who, so funny, he did not get a window table. It's kind of hard, you know, everybody requests a window table. So he said to me, you know, I don't like my view. And I look across and I see that his view is his wife. And I'm trying to, like, bite my tongue. I'm like, you married her. Like, that's not the nice thing to say, but, you know. I'm just like, well, you know, just part of me wants to say, listen, you're in a wonderful position in your life where you can afford a $300 dinner, and isn't it really about sharing the moment with the person that you love the most, and maybe looking at the food, maybe looking at her, and maybe not worrying what's outside? I mean, yeah, it's a nice view, but at the end of the day, it's still the Eisenhower Expressway.
Sure. Or planes flying overhead.
You know, it's so funny. It's just really funny what makes people tick.
Yeah, I mean, it is. It's funny, my first food, my transformative food experience was actually at Everest.
Really?
You know, the first, the amuse was that cauliflower with
the fondant.
Yeah,
the
fondant.
Caviar.
And, you know, to me at the time, it was, like, bad, you know, like, cauliflower is nasty and
well, there's
shakes.
Very little cauliflower in there.
Yeah, it's all
it's
butter,
so
right? And, but I remember having that, and I was like, oh, my God, you know, what have I been doing all this time? And then that, for me, was actually the experience.
Well, that's very good. That's awesome. You know, we all have those moments where, actually, I went to a restaurant last week, and Leilan, you know, and you have your expectations. Like, I'm not a big fan of gourmet fusion food. Mm-hmm. You know, like, if I want to have, like, and it's fine, but, you know, if I want to have really, really good Thai food, I'm going to go to, like, Siam noodle and rice. You know, I don't need the same food, just put on a prettier plate with prettier garnishes.
And charge a lot more.
And so I went and I had this sort of expectation. I was like, oh, I'm not going to like it. You know, it's one of those places that makes, you know, Vietnamese food more than it should be. You know, like, it's like Indian food. Indian food shouldn't be piped out of a pastry bag. It's Indian food. It's comfort food. It's soul food. You know, you're not supposed to make it glamorous. It is what it is, you know. But this chef there, Andy Moto, I mean, he was doing stuff that I didn't think you could possibly do with food, but he wasn't doing it just for the sake of doing it to, like, you know, make you go, you know, like the science experiment. I mean, it was actually done in a way where he's combining fusion cooking with avant-garde cooking techniques. And I haven't seen anybody do that yet. And that's exciting. You know, that's what kind of gets you going nowadays. You know, where you think you've eaten everything and you think, yo, you know, I've tried this, I've tried that. But it's so refreshing to know that, you know, after all this eating, that you could still be amazed and blown away and, you know. But he brought out, like, this duck sort of Vietnamese soup, but it was in, like, this plastic paper, you know, like, done in, like, a, what do they call that thing?
Empapio,
correct, yes. And we cut it open. So, of course, you didn't see that before. But the flavors were so good. And then he did, like, this eggplant beignet. But it was deep fried and then rolled in pistachio and then deep fried. And then it was served with this dried banana curry powder with, like, 27 other things in it. And then, like, this plum sauce. And so you're thinking, oh, wow, you know, that's kind of interesting. But then the flavors actually worked. And it was one of those things where it's like, you know, they have to tell you how to eat it. You look at it like, how am I going to eat this? But it actually really, really worked. It's so tasty.
You alluded to your fiancé, Charles Blackstone, I believe.
Yes.
Right? I was curious about just, you know, what it's like. I know he's a big writer. And do you find yourself, are you popping up in any of his stuff? Or does he ever make allusions to
you know, he actually just handed me his second book. I'm the first to read it. It's called Bézé. His first book was really interesting because he got a lot of a field actually an interest in an anthology he's working on, but it's the week you weren't here, and a lot of people said, oh, it's autobiographical. He's like, no. He's like, I use certain experiences of my own life, you know, which it's a book about this guy who goes out on many, 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 many dates, and I read it when we first met, and here it's kind of interesting because I really like this guy, and yet I'm reading, you know, supposedly encounters, you know, with him dating other women and, you know, getting romantically involved and, you know, lusting over this one character. And I'm just like, who's Dewey? Who is she? Like, she's just, you know, she's just a culmination of a couple of different women. I'm like, well.
He didn't even say it was a literary invention.
No. Yeah, it was really interesting. But no, it was really strange. You know, it was really, really strange. But I have not read anything yet of, you know, my character popping up or things that I have heard actually, or I have seen things that I'll say, like inside jokes and stuff like that. So, you know, my little sayings will pop up here and there, or, you know, just things that I've, like, noticed or witnessed, et cetera, et cetera. So.
Is he a wine guy?
He likes wine.
Yeah.
Yes, he likes wine. So. He does enjoy wine. He doesn't, you know, he's like the best wine drinker. If I put it in front of him, he'll drink it. You know, he won't go, oh, how many points did that get? Or what is that? I don't drink that. So.
did you do all the ordering on the first dates?
The first date, we had lots of vodka. It was really interesting because the first date, I must have had like 7 vodka sodas. And he tried keeping up with me and just got hammered. And then I realized, I said, God, I don't understand why I keep going out with these guys that just end up getting loaded. And then in his drunken haze, he's like, I was just trying to keep up with you. I'm like, I never thought about that. I'm like, I never thought that my tolerance would be kind of a detriment to my dating life. I'm like, yeah, I guess you're right.
Yeah.
You know? Because, I mean, at that point, I could drink a lot and not worry about it because, you know, that's what I do for a living. But it never occurred to me that when you get, like, a civilian, so to speak, trying to keep up with a sommelier, that they don't necessarily have the tolerance, and he just got hammered. but
there's probably a lot of that in your life. I mean, like, there's probably a wine intimidation, like people might be worried about bringing over a bottle of wine.
Well, I remember one guy that I went on a date with. We met at a Mediterranean restaurant. It was BYOB. So I bought, like, you know, brought, like, 3 bottles of wine. He's like, are we all going to, we're going to drink that, like, in one sitting? I'm like, yeah. I'm like, oh, that's right. You know, you're a normal person. You can't drink a bottle and a half of wine in one sitting.
I was reading that, I think, Robert Parker drinks, like, 10,000, or tries 10,000 different wines.
Yeah, quite a bit.
I'm curious how many you're tasting on a regular basis.
Well, I'm actually, now I'm purchasing for Osteria. So I go there once a week and taste through. Like, last Thursday, I tried probably about 70 wines. So then you give a taste. I'm probably doing, like, 100 a week, I would say. Just, you know, not terribly too much, but it's about normal. So I would say on average, sommeliers taste between 400 to 1,000 wines a month. You know, retasting, tasting. And if you're on the floor, it's more because you're tasting every night. So I don't do that anymore where I work on the floor. So I would say I probably stick to about 300-400 a month, which is about normal. But, you know, the funny about the tolerance situation is my tolerance has gone down since being in a steady relationship. Because I think, you know, when you're single, you tend to booze more.
Sure. Yeah. The ups and downs.
Perpetually single, so you go out, you drown your sorrows in a few cocktails,
and if you don't find anybody, you keep drinking.
No, I went out like 3 weeks ago, and I had 3 martinis, and I don't remember getting home. It's like, what did you do to me? Like, my tolerance. You know, this is a job hazard.
Yeah, you're gonna have to give up wine because of your life.
Probably not a good, healthy thing to do. Drinking 7 vodka sodas in a night. No, I mean, we taste quite a few wines. You know, it's interesting because this position I've had since September where I'm not on the floor. So it's a complete different life, you know, having the 9-to-5 schedule, or the 9-to-5-ish schedule, I should say. You know, having your weekends free. So I was at a party last night, and I ran into some old sommelier friends, and they're still on the floor, and you know, it's different. You know, they can't do the Friday, Saturday night thing. They work nights. And so I've lived in Chicago for 6 years, and it was only recently in the last couple of months that I went to the opera and the symphony. And so it's like a whole new city has been opened up to me because I can go to places at night.
Is that a good trade-off? I mean, do you sometimes wish that you were on the floor, or is that something you don't miss?
I did it for 5 years. So, and I did it 5 nights a week for 5 years straight. I don't miss it, and it also became kind of a, doing the show, it became kind of a, I don't know. It became difficult to do my job properly, and so it's one of the reasons why I decided to just, you know, it's time to get off the floor. You know, at Everest, you know, I'd go to a table, and it's their 50th, you know, wedding anniversary, or 50th birthday, and they'd want to talk about me, and it's just, it's not appropriate, you know, and I didn't want to upset people and give them the impression that I was being, you know, rude or snobby. It's just like, no, I'm like, you're here to enjoy your dinner and you're spending good money. I want this to be about you, and this is the time and place to tell me how your cousin would be a great guest on the show. You know, so it just became difficult. And it's like, you know, maybe it's time to try something different and see what else is out there. You know, the days were becoming like Groundhog Day, where I couldn't differentiate between Wednesday from Friday.
Right.
You know,
it's just... You could lose your passion.
Well, you know, you get up, you know what to do. Like, you could just go blindfolded and go through the same routine. And the last couple of years, it was like, I gotta find something new. I'm like...
How are you spending your time now in terms of your efforts? And I mean, it's a lot of strategy about...
You know, it's just really... It's more creative energy rather than physical energy, and that's where the difference is. I mean, my other job, I'd have to physically do things, you know, physically put the wine away, physically be on the floor, you know, so a lot of physicalness. And now it's more creative, where you look at something and you, you know, or you see trends and you think, where could we apply that? You know, where could this be useful? You know, and that's a lot of what lettuce does, is trying to figure out new ways to do things, you know, new ways to do old things, and make it exciting and fun and approachable for people. And wine is one of those things that's extremely intimidating. And so how do you take something that's extremely intimidating and complicated and make it user-friendly for our guests, and more importantly, for our employees to try to sell it, you know, sell it appropriately and effectively? And so, you know, thinking outside the box when it comes to training and education, because most of the training and education is geared with this sort of snooty, snotty, over-your-head language, you know, when you get into malolactic fermentation and clonal selection and, you know, even the term acid.
Sure.
You know, when you start talking about structure and tannins, it's, you know, et cetera, et cetera. And you're giving this information to, you know, a server who, what am I going to do with malolactic? Mm-hmm. You know, how am I going to sell with malolactic? And that's a lot of what training in the wine business traditionally set up as. And so, you know, it's trying to like figure out, how can we take something that's so complicated and make it fun to learn about, you know, and make it, you know, where they can take the information and give it to the guest. Mm-hmm. You know, because one of the number one complaints that people have about wine is when I go out to dinner, yeah, sure, when you're at Everest or True or Ombria, there's a sommelier, but what happens when I go to a more casual restaurant? You know, how do I ask for help when the server is not even old enough to drink sometimes, you know? That's another issue. So, I mean, how do I get guidance? And so what I've been doing a lot of is trying experimental sort of approaches on how to teach wine. And one of the things is trying to be very specific about the language and make sure that I don't use things like gooseberry, you know, or grassiness. Because I've seen a gooseberry maybe once in my life. That's because I went out and tried to look for it, because gooseberry is like, you know, a very common descriptor for New Zealand Sauvignon Blanc. Like, I've never seen a gooseberry. I don't know what it tastes like. Why am I using it?
Yeah.
And how do I expect other people?
It's like,
yeah.
We met at that Jay McInerney reading, you know, I asked about, you know, it's like, I don't even know what unctuous means.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah, like, exactly. And then you try to, like, you know, tell, well, Jay McInerney, I mean, yeah, I mean, he's been a very brilliant approach of how to describe it, you know, like Pamela Anderson or whatever. And people get that. And I've actually been using that technique, you know, for years now. So I was very happy to see, you know, when I read his book. I only recently read his book, Bacchus and Me. I was like, wow, this is great. This is refreshing. This is funny. This is not snobby. This is entertaining. And that's what the business needs right now, is it needs that approach to wine. You know, because people want to learn about it, but they don't want to have to, like, weed through the unctuous, you know, hedonistic gobs of fruit descriptors to get to it.
Do you think people rely too much on the rating systems? You
know? Well, that's because that's what they're taught to do. And it's really frustrating being in this business where people say, oh, people think too much about spectator, think about wine enthusiasts, you know, the points and scores, you know, they think too much about it. And I'm thinking, we're all guilty, because what do we do? What do we put on the bottles? We
sure.
put wine spectator score. So we have made it important, and therefore the consumers just follow our lead and say, well, that must be the, you know, way to do it. You know, what we really should be doing is, yeah, sure, you know, use the magazines as a guide, you know, or whatever, to find new appellations, new regions. But what we should really be teaching people is, you know, pay attention to your own palate and have confidence in knowing that if you don't like something, well, you don't like it. Who cares? Because too many people say, you know, I don't know anything. I'm not a connoisseur. I'm sure it's fine. I don't know anything. You know, I'm like, well, you're not going to go into a car dealership and say, just pick out a car for me. I don't know anything. Just make sure it's green. You know,
you're
it's like, well, you're going to drink it. You do know what you like. And there's no difference between wine and a hamburger. It's all about taste. Mm-hmm. You know, and it's just like, you don't need to be a connoisseur to enjoy a hamburger. Or let's just take something even more of an analogy. I mean, a vodka. You know, or beer. Mm-hmm. You know, there's just no snobbery attached to that. You know, somebody tries Grey Goose versus Kettle, they're not going to say, well, I'm not sophisticated, it's lost on me. But for some reason, wine does have that intimidation where you can give something to somebody and you use the terms, well, very subtle notes of blah, 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 blah. So subtle that only the most, you know, appreciating palate to be able to pick it up.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, they're thinking, well, oh God, you know, I'm not a discriminating palate, what do I know? So, I mean, it's just, sometimes that just gets a little funky. We should be teaching people to think, you like it, you don't like mm-hmm. it, you know? If you don't like it, big deal, there's more out there, you know?
Yeah, I think what's tough, I think it's like, your job as a sommelier is really to assess somebody's palate and recommend what's going to be good for them. And
oh God!
It's like, how do you do that?
It's therapy. It really is. Like, you know, we're standing at the table and we're listening to people use these descriptors. I want something smooth without a bite, and I don't want an aftertaste. And I was on vacation about 10 years ago, and I had this wine. It started with an M, and it had a butterfly on the label. Do you know what it was? Okay. Sometimes I could get it. That was the funny thing.
Well, yeah.
But, no, I would start asking them questions like, well, you know, when you're at home, what do you normally drink? Or the last time you went out to dinner and you got a bottle of wine, what was it? I always tell people, don't get stuck up on the, you know, the peaches, blueberries, and pineapples of the wine. Name specific wines. You know, I'm looking for a Pinot Grigio. I'm looking something like a Cabernet Sauvignon. But I don't want to spend that much money. What else do you have that tastes like a Cabernet Sauvignon that has the structure of it? You know, that makes more sense. So I would find myself just in reverse asking people questions like, well, you know, what's your favorite wine? You know, don't worry about the blueberries and peaches and the structure, et cetera, et cetera. Just tell me, you know, what's your favorite wine? What do you like to drink? Oh, I like Shiraz. Okay, well, do you want something lighter than that? Do you want something more full body? You know, and then that way you're trying to have a better gauge of trying to get what they want. The number one area that I always got tripped up on was fruity versus dry. I want something dry. It's like, okay, well, do you want dryness as no sugar, because that's the correct term for dryness, or do you want dryness meaning oakiness? Because a lot of people think tannins are dry, or they think butteriness or oakiness is that dry. So that was kind of tough, the dry factor.
Figuring out what subtle cues they're giving me and what they mean and translating them.
Yeah, and then, you know, the other, if you ask most sommeliers, what's your most frustrating thing about wine? It's like, well, people don't drink rosés, and people don't like sweet wines. No.
It's because everybody's buying like the $5 bottle of Riesling that's like super cloying. And
I just love Riesling and Pinot Gris. I like a little sweetness.
It's great, but I think what people are drinking is not the good stuff. You know, it's the stuff in the blue bottle. Or
like,
you know.
No, this isn't. Well, Blue Nun has no Riesling in it, which is the funny thing. There's no Riesling in that wine. Yeah, it's like some other grape. It's like Welsh Riesling or something, but Müller-Thurgau, but there's no Riesling in it. Or there's very little Riesling, I should say, but there's no Riesling.
So you talked a little bit about palate, and you know, there's been a lot lately. I think I've been reading about like super tasters and things like that. Do you know? I mean, are you a super taster? Do you know if you have like, you know, crazy palate, like, or?
Well, the only thing that I can say for sure is that women are better tasters than men, and you know, sort of a known fact, and you know, many doctors will back it up. I think tasting more than anything is a it's a muscle, and the more you taste and the more you pay attention to it, the better you get. And the thing is, you have to pay attention to it. And as I get older and I taste more, I build up my scent bank. And I pay attention to everything that I smell, taste, encounter when I'm cooking. You know, I'll smell dill, or I'll smell, you know, black pepper. I mean, I'll really try to memorize that smell. So I don't think that there is a so-called super palate. I think it's just people who have spent a period of time paying attention and building a scent bank. Because for the most part, before I got into this business, I wouldn't pay attention to how my food tasted. I wouldn't. You know, I'd drink something. But, you know, how much of it are we really pausing and analyzing the structure and the texture and, you know, where it's hitting us on the palate and the finish, how long the flavor lasts when, you know, you've swallowed it. And so I think a lot of it has to do with just pausing and just paying attention to the everyday flavors, not just in food, but like in life in general. Like, you know, passing a garden, like, ooh, white flowers, hyacinth, ooh, that smells good. And so I will comment on smells like all the time. Like, God, doesn't it smell like so-and-so or so-and-so? Like yesterday when it was just about to rain, that wet pavement smell started to happen. So, I mean, I pay attention to those smells. And so I think it's just really more paying attention.
Yeah, I know. I think I read that you said it's you had to teach yourself to remember scents.
Yeah, you do.
And so you think it's just a function of being more conscious, whereas most of us aren't. Most of us are just going, putting it in. And
yeah, you know. At least that's how I was. Yeah. I was never paying attention. I mean, I'm not saying all people don't pay attention.
Sure.
But for the most part, when I... Before I got to the business, I mean, I would eat like a tuna fish sandwich, and then I'd have my soda. Okay, so I eat my tuna fish sandwich, I drink my soda. I didn't pay attention to how the soda changed the flavor of the food. Mm-hmm. Now, I find myself paying attention, and right. then I'll point it out to other people, like, oh my God, look how that Arizona iced tea changed the flavor of it because it picked up the cilantro.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so it's just not even with wine, it's just everyday life. Or, do you smell that? Do you smell that? My ex-roommate has hated living with me because he's just like, your nose is just so, like, tuned in.
Mm-hmm.
I'm like, that's because I'm always on.
Yeah.
You know, I can't take smell out of my life. I smell everything.
Yeah.
You know? So it's funny, though, because Charles has no smell whatsoever.
Really?
He has no smell. He wears no deodorant, nothing. The guy just does not smell. I'm like, it's so funny because, you know, we actually, you know, we share a closet, obviously. And so, right. like, I'll go in and, like, try to figure out a smell or, mm-hmm. like, periodically smell him. I'm like, you have no scent.
Yeah.
It's bizarre. Like, that the only bizarre. Scent that he has is, like, his shaving uh-huh. cream and, like, his soap.
Yeah.
But there's
Which is just, like, the aloe or whatever.
He has no scent.
Huh.
It's bizarre.
I've never heard that. Because no. they usually say, like, you have a sense of that, like, if you're with somebody for a long time.
No, I'm looking for his scent. I can't find his scent. He is without scent. Huh. The only scent that he has is, like, his hair products or anything artificial. But, like, you know, he works out a lot, and he wears no deodorant, and he does not smell.
Huh.
Isn't that bizarre?
It could be convenient.
I did notice one day, though, that he changed his shaving cream.
Yeah.
I said, oh, you changed your shaving cream. He's like, how'd you know that? I'm like, I can smell it. I'm like, don't try to cheat on me. I'll smell it on you.
Dude, the perils of dating a sommelier.
Really, it's funny. Yeah. Or I woke up one day and I was like, do you smell that? He's like, what? I'm like, the pilot light went off. He's like, I don't smell what you're smelling. And they go, no, smell it. It smells. Turned out, yeah, the pilot light was
and
off.
And that's good. That's very good. Yeah. That you were able to pick up on that.
Yeah. But it's like, yeah. Just always smelling. So, like I said, I don't think... I think what does help in the wine business, though, is I do have a photographic memory.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that has something to do with it. And because, you know, you do have to, like, absorb massive amounts of information. But I think if you're just going to do it for everyday life, you know, you don't really need a photographic memory. But most of my colleagues that I know of can remember the most, like, minute details. Like,
I think it's funny. I was reading, I think, an interview with you where you talked about... you know, when you were hanging out with other sommeliers and you asked the question, so what do you do other than wine? And they kind of looked at you like,
what else is there?
What else is there? And you're like, oh, good. I'm not the only one.
I've actually tried to get into other things, so.
Yeah, I was going to say, is that still true? I mean.
No, I tried knitting for a while. That didn't work out. Kept dropping stitches. And then I found out it was cool to do knitting and I don't like to do anything that's cool.
Yeah, well, it's the hipster thing.
But I'm working on a book, so that's taking up a lot of time.
Can you talk about that? What's the
book?
Yeah, what's
sure. It's called Alpen of Pores, about being a woman, loving wine, and having great relationships. And it's sort of a book that was inspired by my time working at Everest and observing the faux pas and the drama of human relationships around wine. And I found myself just like, you know, talking to my girlfriends, being single for a long time, and then, you know, just with meeting Charles, I was like, wow, you know, it's interesting. I said, there's a lot of analogies that you can make with wine and dating, you know, and how women can use wine as a way to improve their relationships, not just in, you know, dating relationships, but in like business relationships and family relationships. Just relationships in general is an extremely important part of trying to, like, you know, socialize and mobilize. And so, you know, it was really unfortunate because you see, like, a big business dinner, and the woman's, you know, entertaining, and she's in charge, and then the wine list came, and then you would see that physical handoff of power to somebody else to go pick the wine. Like, well, you know, you don't need to do that. There is a really fun, easy way to learn about wine, and it's not necessarily a book that's going to discuss, you know, like I said, the malolactic fermentation, how wine is made. You know, there's lots of great books out there that do that. What this really is trying to figure out a fun, humorous way, you know, to learn how to purchase it
mm-hmm.
and what to do with it.
Mm-hmm.
So it gives information like how to buy wines for, you know, like if you're throwing a wedding shower or birthday or bachelorette party, or if you're trying to buy wines for the boss, how to entertain with wine at home or at restaurants. And then just like funny things, like, at least I think they're funny. Like, you know, what a guy orders at a date, what it says about him.
Huh.
If he orders a glass of wine, you know, his intentions are not long term. So you're not worth the full bottle, you know? Or he probably wants to get out of this as quickly as possible. If he orders a bottle of champagne, well, that's a bit of a Casanova activity.
So and I'm a Casanova because I love champagne.
Casanova activity. And then, more importantly, he should probably ask what you would like first, mm-hmm. and then go from there.
is there scientific evidence from observation, or is that more of an anthropological, or is it anthropological?
It's just social observation. It's just something that I observe, mm-hmm. you know? Like, I saw this engagement one time, and it cracked me up in a sad way, actually. I mean, there was an engagement, like, 3 times a week at Everest. I mean, it's just, you became, like, you wanted to, like, hold up a sign and go, oh, 9.0, you know? But this guy came in, and he's like, oh, my Mercedes is having problems, you know, and you know, I call the dealership, and if you just let me know when they're here. I'm like, okay, no worries. And so we knew that was a proposal. So we see the ring go on her finger, like, you know, with not too much fanfare, which is fine. It's a public place, whatever. Well, he walks off to go deal with his Mercedes. And she's, like, sitting there looking at the ring. And I wanted to tell her, like, I seriously wanted to pull up a chair, pour, like, 2 glasses. I'm like, honey, if the Mercedes is a problem, like, it's like, the priority here. This is the most important, one of the most important days in your life. And he obviously has set precedent by saying that his car is more important than sitting here in the afterglow of proposing with you. And wine is like a bottle of wine. Or, like, you know, dating is like a bottle of wine. If it's, like, rocky from the start and it doesn't taste good, you know, it's just going to get worse over time. You have to have good material to work with. Mm-hmm. And then it'll just mellow out as time takes it along. But if it tastes crappy now, it's just going to get worse.
Mm-hmm. That's very apt.
You know, so you see stuff like that. Like, the Bluetooth thing cracks me up. You know, I would never, one of my rules was I never would date a guy with a Bluetooth, because that's just automatically set precedent again that I'm going to interrupt you any moment now because this phone call is going to be more important. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, there's a time and place to do everything. You don't need to be, like, wired 100% of the time. I mean, how many pictures have you seen of Bill Gates, who's arguably one of the busiest men in the world? Even he doesn't wear a Bluetooth.
Yeah. That's because all his people wear Bluetooth.
Exactly. Exactly. So if you are, you know, and there's a time and place, but if you are out with your significant other, if you're out, you know, having fun, I mean, put it away. It's only an hour or so. Just put it away. You know? We can live without clothes. We can live without a house. You know, we can live with a lot of things, but we cannot live without eating. So in essence, we work to eat. So why don't we just take that time, whatever it is, an hour and a half, 2 hours, and just pause and just really enjoy it for what it's worth and not have the distractions of everyday life. I think we're just all just, like, trying to do so much more than ever, and enjoying our life and enjoying eating and celebrating has not become a priority. Mm-hmm. You know, so I always tell them, like, you got to watch out for the Bluetooth. At least if he doesn't put it away at dinner, you're in trouble.
And sometimes I think, too, the thing I think with food, too, is people equate food too often to the cost of the food, you know? Mm-hmm. It's become this, like, so the guy who has the Mercedes is also eating at Everest because Everest costs a lot, not necessarily because has a discerning palate or he's looking for a good meal. He's just looking for the status involved with that. You know, it's like I find now that as I write more about food, you know, there's sort of like two groups of people who eat, and there's people who eat for the pleasure of eating, and, you know, they don't care if it's high or low, and then there's people who equate the greatness of their experience to the cost mm-hmm. of the meal. You know, it's like, oh, well, I ate at Alinea and Charlie Trotter this week, and, you know, so I must know what I'm talking about.
Well, I'm not a big Ayn Rand fan, but, because I think she writes, you know, she's a good writer, but she's just too long, and I don't have the energy to sit through 300 pages of describing the dining scene. You know, but there are Ayn Rand fans out there,
sure,
or Ayn Rand, whatever her name is. And so, but there was this one scene in The Fountainhead, or is it Atlas Shrugged? Was it Atlas Shrugged?
You have a photographic memory.
It was Atlas Shrugged. Yeah, it was Atlas Shrugged, because it was Reardon. And so, Dagny Taggart and Reardon. So she was having an affair with him, obviously, and so they were having dinner in this restaurant, and Reardon, she said, you know, he was just one of those guys that, you know, other people in the room needed the room, the extravagance and the wealth of the room to define them. But Reardon defined the room. You know, and so I was just thought that was really interesting and very poetic, you know, especially working at a place like Empress, because, you know, you did have people that did need to be seen in that sort of opulence and wealth because they needed it to define them. But you did have diners where they defined the room. And there's a huge difference where two people, you know, could be sitting in a chair side by side at, you know, different tables, and the ambiance and the aura about their attitude and the way they behave are completely different. I mean, it's extremely, extremely fascinating. So I did find customers that, you know, we were there to for them to, you know, bash and make fun of and, you know, whatever, and order around. And then other people, they're just there to have a great time and enjoy themselves. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's really interesting. Oh. I had this one customer, Dr. Cerullo. He's a famous neurologist here in Chicago. He's at Rush. One of my favorite customers of all time. You know, here's this guy that is one of the top neurosurgeons in the country, and always happy and smiling. And I just saw him a month ago, and he was just happy, happy, happy. And so I said, Dr. Cerullo, I said, you're always happy. You know, I'm like, what's the secret? He's like, because I see so much despair and death around me. He's like, this is all we have.
Yeah. Perspective is, yeah, is a big important, yeah, thing, you know?
I was like, well, you know, I think it's so, I think one thing I love about you is that, you know, you are extremely, you know, and you hear these things about doctors sometimes, you know, they're snotty, snobby, whatever. I'm like, but you don't have an ounce of that in you. He's like, you know, like I said, at the end of the day, all we can do is smile. Mm-hmm. You know, and it's just, he was just one of those guys that, you know, really, it was a joy to be around him. And you got the sense that, you know, here's this guy who probably, you know, twice a week had to tell somebody you've got 3 months to live. You know, so it really, he really, really had perspective, but he embodied that perspective. Mm-hmm. You know, and that was awesome when you got to meet people like that. And then you meet the putzes, you know.
Yeah. I mean, because not all surgeons are like that, yeah.
No, yeah, he's just... If you ever meet him, you'll see him. I mean, he's a big, jolly guy and always smiling and having a great time. But I'll never forget that. He's like, at the end of the day, a smile is all we have.
It's true. It's true. And principal.
Yeah, and principal. So, really great guy.
I'm curious about our generation. So, like, you know, late 20s, you know, mid-20s, people who are growing up now. And their wine habits, you know, in a sense of, like, I think one of the things I worry about is, or maybe it's not worth worrying about, I don't know. I think there's two schools of thought. One is, you know, our generation is growing up with sort of like the two-buck chuck, and, you know, we're more, you know, we don't equate price necessarily to quality, and so we're willing to go out and find the $5 or $10 bottle of wine. You know, but our, you know, I guess, and so that would be to say we experiment a lot and we're being more exposed to wine and we're more willing to take chances. But then the other flip of that is, you know, are we getting bad wines at that level? Or, you know, are
no,
we?
I would rather, I shop at Trader Joe's. Mm-hmm. And so I see, you know, women especially going in there and getting cases and cases of wine. I'd rather have them drinking wine than have them drinking, you know, soda or whatever. So at least they are enjoying. And if you go to European countries, they don't drink Barolos and Brunellos every day. I mean, those are for special occasions. They drink, you know, Barberas and whatever the house wine is, whatever they've made in the backyard. And so the idea of wine is to have a little bit of something every single day. And if we're going to survive as an industry, we need to have that a little bit every day. And the expensive fine wine market is such a small segment of, you know, what we do of the industry. It's very, very small, the $60, $70 ones. But it's like anything, you have to have the entry point. You know, you have to have the gateway, you know, without sounding too cliche here.
Sure, sure.
But, you know, $2 chuck or the $5, you know, the zoofication of the wine aisle, you know, with all the animals,
sure,
and stuff.
Penguin.
Yeah, the penguin, the smoking loon, you know, et cetera. The kangaroos that go to Rome. You know, it's a good entry point because it allows them to make wine a part of their life in an everyday way. It takes the stigma away from them. It gets them to experiment with different, you know, varietals, different styles. You know, if they're having pizza, they're enjoying a glass of this or Shiraz or whatever it is. And then when they go out to dinner, that intimidation factor has already been removed. So if the, you know, the language they're very much familiar with, of like, oh, I like Shiraz, or I like, you know, Muscadet, I like Pinot Blanc, that's normally what I drink. But, you know, obviously I'm not going to, you know, I'm going to splurge tonight. And so it makes my job easier. It makes the servers that I train easier, where they can go in, and rather than starting from scratch of an entry point wine, they can upgrade to something else. You know, even if it is just for one night. And so, and with the quality, I can understand what you're saying. You know, do these wines taste good? And yes, they actually are good because the technology is getting so much better and the expertise and the know-how is getting so much better. And so, you know, like Australia, I mean, it's just a hotbed of innovation and technology. And these, you know, so-called flying winemakers are traveling all over the world, to Argentina and Chile, even Hungary or Slovenia, you know, wherever it is. And they're like, okay, this is what you do. Bulgaria. You know, you need to clean up your winemaking, install these modern, you know, wine tanks, you know, get this going, get that going, and the land is cheaper, the labor is cheaper, everything's cheaper, and so the output is a great $7 bottle of wine.
Sure.
You know, slap an animal on it, send it on its way.
The wine is displaced, the animals are displacing the 100-point system.
I was out to dinner, and I saw this party of four at this Thai restaurant. They had a magnum of yellowtail. I was like, wow, that's a rockin' good time, you know? And I said, well, at least they're drinking something. And I know that when they do go to a really nice restaurant, like Blackburn or whatever it is, and they want to get something, they'll at least have a starting point, a reference point, of at least being introduced to the product. But I think what's really encouraging about our generation is the fact that, you know, it's much more of a melting pot, but you still have the same experience. And so what that means, I mean, I grew up in a classroom full of people from like 10 different ethnic backgrounds. And, you know, Charles has an 11-year-old sister. I mean, she knows about African food. She knows the difference between Thai and Vietnamese spring rolls. I mean, just extremely knowledgeable about food in general. I mean, I didn't know what hummus was until I was like 18, you know? Mm-hmm. But with that being said, I mean, you have exposure to so many different ethnic backgrounds, and, you know, traveling has become much more common, of going, you know, backpacking to India or going to Australia or going to all these places, going to South America. You know, with that comes an exposure and an ease of trying things that are new and different. And so where maybe my parents weren't as likely to try things that weren't Indian, my generation is extremely likely to try things from different backgrounds and different regions. Whereas, you know, 15 years ago, how likely, well, maybe sushi's a bad example, but sushi's actually a good example. I mean, you see 8-year-olds eating sushi.
Sure.
When I was 8, ew, I eat sushi.
Sure.
So I think it's going to become better and better and better. And as we get older and have children and wine is at the table, they will discuss it, talk about it. But it's not a taboo. It's not something that's elite. It's not something I'm going to go grab something from the cellar. You know, it's not something that's sort of, you know, shrouded with mystery and intrigue and intimidation. It's just something that's on the table.
Right.
It's like, you know, and if it's going to, you know, so like, oh, it's the Coca-Colaization of wine. I'm like, well, Coca-Cola is a really good selling product, mm-hmm. and there's a lot of people employed by the Coca-Cola business.
Sure.
And what's wrong with that?
Yeah, I met with Doug Zell of Intelligentsia a few weeks ago, and we were talking, and, you know, the thing that him and almost everybody who works at Intelligentsia will say is that Starbucks is a good thing, you know, because they do serve a good quality cup of coffee, but they've also opened people's idea or their minds up to the idea that there is this nuance and this greatness about coffee that, you know, used to be Folgers and, you know, Sanka or 8 a.m. from A&P.
Oh, my God. I mean, 15 years ago, macchiato? What the heck is that? Now people are going, that's not a macchiato. That there's milk in there. Macchiato is an espresso with foam, not milk.
I want a double ristretto shot. You know,
yeah, it's like, people know about that now, and I think it's, you know, wine is very similar. I mean, focaccia is another thing, you know. You have any, or balsamic vinegar, mm-hmm. foie gras.
Mm-hmm. Not anymore in Chicago. Yeah,
well, that's another issue.
Do you remember your first conscious glass of wine or your first wine memory? What was
my
that?
My first wine memory was involved a bottle of something in a jug. I think it was like E&J Gallo Chablis or something like that. Not the good Chablis. But my dad got a gift from work for a bottle of this, and it was in the refrigerator, and I was 8 at the time, and the back of it said, you know, flavors of peaches, apricots, and honey. So it was literally expecting those flavors. So I poured myself a glass and it was horrid. Mm. It was dry. So I'm like, this does not taste like apricots and honey.
And then you made a career of wine.
Yeah, so, and then, you know, you had the wine cooler, so. My mother, I had an older cousin that lived with us, he's 10 years older, and so he convinced her to buy wine coolers. And so my mother didn't realize that they were alcohol-based, and so we kept drinking them because they were tasty, and then, of course, we got a little tipsy, and my dad came home, and was like, what are these kids up to, you know? And, like, yelled at my mother because, you know, wine coolers had alcohol in it. The bottles of Jinx, wine coolers, you know. Funny when you're 7 or 8, not so funny when you're 22.
Right. And not so funny when you're a parent, I would guess.
My mother didn't know. I mean, that's the joys of being, you know, raised as an immigrant for a parent, because there's no censorship, there's no expectation, there's nothing, you know, and so you're growing up trying to figure out life, and they're trying to figure out the culture at the same time, so it's almost like the blind leading the blind, and, you know, trying to tell your mother about things like Easter and Girl Scouts and prom, etc., SATs, and it's like you have to tell them everything, and then some, of course, they figure out, you know, themselves, but it's really makes for a very fascinating way to grow up. I mean, we were watching, like, Eddie Murphy, Delirious, you know, at, like, 6 years old, laughing our tushes off, not knowing what half of it was. Right. It was just really funny. You know, my dad's, like, sitting there watching it with us, because there's no censorship. It's like, okay, whatever, you know? So.
Yeah, I think it was funny reading about your experience, because, you know, I think the typical post-first-generation experience for a lot of Indian Americans happens, like, you know, a lot of my friends grew up in these very stringent families where, like, you know, everything was regulated, and, you know, they were studying to become doctors at like 7 or, you know, whatever it was. And it's interesting to see how you had, it seems like a more free form existence.
I did, just as long as my grades were good. Mm-hmm. You know, because grades are bragging rights with Indian parents, because it's a reflection of what you're doing. But no, I mean, everybody expects their children to be a doctor. But the funny thing is, Indian people don't go to doctors. Mm-hmm. So everybody's supposed to be a doctor, but nobody actually goes to a doctor. So it doesn't make sense. And they all go to Harvard. I mean, Harvard must be like 80% Indian. Because everybody goes to Harvard or Yale or Princeton.
Sure. The Ivies.
The Ivies must be 80% Indian.
The public Ivies.
I mean, it's hilarious.
Yeah.
We should have like an Indian temple built on like, you know, every single Ivy League campus.
But you know, it's good. I mean, I think people figure out what they want to do. And then you have a lot of these great folks like M. Night Shyamalan like movies. Or
it's a very fascinating culture because, you know, you have old world traditions, old world work ethic, old world values. But then you have this sort of like, you know, weird thing with Western life. So it's like an interesting blend between Western and Eastern. And you use Eastern work ethic to apply it to the Western world. And that's what ends up happening. And so you find that, you know, a lot of, you know, us Indians, especially the more successful ones, are extremely blindly ambitious. Mm-hmm. And sometimes in a blatantly arrogant sort of way, sort of that arrogant confidence of like, well, I'm just going to do it. Mm-hmm. It's interesting.
But that's good. I mean, you know.
Yeah. It's just like, I'm just going to do it.
Say you get together a group of people over a bottle of wine. It could be anybody, living, dead, that kind of thing. Who would you invite? You know, why? Why would you want to talk to them? And what would that bottle be?
Huh, that's a good question. I have to think about that for a second. I think it'd be really cool to meet Gandhi. Mm-hmm. Really cool. You know, just talk about, you know, his way of doing things, and seems like a very intelligent. I saw Gandhi when I was a little kid, and mm-hmm. I've just always been fascinated with Gandhi. So Mahatma Gandhi would be really cool. Bill Clinton. I love Bill.
Who doesn't?
I just think he's awesome.
He is awesome. Especially now that we have perspective. Again, perspective.
Just the idea of Bill Clinton, Mahatma Gandhi. Of course, Charles will have to be there because we'd have to talk about it later on, how great it was, and just rehash it. Go, can you believe he did that? That was really funny. And then Larry David, just for mm-hmm. kicks.
Sure.
So Larry David, Bill Clinton, Mahatma Gandhi, and then I'd have to have a woman in there somewhere. Ellen DeGeneres would be really cool.
I watched 4 hours of Ellen yesterday. I'm proud to say, but I'm an insane Ellen fan. I don't know why. There's just something about her. There's the way she relates, you know.
Yeah.
It's kind of like an Oprah thing, but it's even like more to the people now. You know, she's got.
I think she's hilarious. I think Larry David, yeah, Bill Clinton, Ellen. But I'd want to have like a one-on-one with Gandhi first,
mm-hmm.
because I don't know how he would relate with everybody else, you know. But it would be fun.
That should relate really well.
No, it would be really funny to see Larry David and Mahatma Gandhi kind of go off.
Yeah.
Woody Allen would be kind of funny in that mix too.
Yeah. Yeah.
But
although Larry David would have a lot.
No,
of that.
I think Larry David, Mahatma Gandhi, Bill Clinton, and Ellen DeGeneres, and Charles. And I think it would be champagne.
Champagne.
Yeah.
Rosé or
Rosé.
Rosé.
Yeah.
Excellent.
I think that would be pretty funny, actually.
It would be. It'd be. Well, you know, I think dinner parties, like the great dinner parties, are always the ones where you have people who are completely different from each other, because that spurs, you know, it challenges people. If people are too comfortable, they never get out of their comfort zone.
Yeah. No, absolutely. I think that would be actually very entertaining.
You probably have some really interesting things happen with Mahatma Gandhi and Larry David in that room.
Well, because you know Mahatma Gandhi and Bill Clinton would talk like about, you know, politics, mm-hmm. but then Larry David would give his own like funny way to do things, and then Ellen would chime right in. So, and then I would just sit there and laugh.
Yeah. Cool. Thanks for doing this.
Oh, my pleasure.
So thanks again for listening this week. You know, please drop me your feedback at mjnagren@hungrymag.com. And as always, we're part of the Culinary Podcast Network, www.culinarypodcastnetwork.com. So anyway, see you next week, and hey, stay hungry.